Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 36. I'm recording it on Friday, October 31st, 2008. The PE10 level today is at 16. That's fair value. So stocks purchased today offer a strong long-term value proposition. It is certainly possible that if you purchase stocks today, you're going to see another huge price drop. We could see a price drop of as much as 50% in upcoming years, although we also may not. We don't know. But if you hold your stocks purchased today for 10 years or longer, the odds are with you in terms of obtaining a good return on your money. The title of this one is Wall Street to Blame? And of course, we're talking about the passive investing stock crash of 2008. Podcast number 35. It was entitled The Greenspan Mistake, focused on a wonderful article in the New York Times by David Brooks, dated October 27th, 2008, and entitled The Behavioral Revolution. Listen to that one if you have the time. I think that was important. The article is important, and much of the podcast was just going over the material in that article, because what David Brooks did in that article is he's the first person. Well, Greenspan is the first big name I have seen to have said the words, "I was wrong." I've been saying for a long time now that the key to getting away from all this ugliness and this depression and negativity is having some of the big name leaders, the big name experts, acknowledge their mistakes. And Greenspan has not done that. Former Fed Chairman Greenspan has said, "I was wrong. I made a mistake." And David Brooks, in his article, talks about the future of investing. The future of investing is behavioral finance. The passive investing model failed because the passive investing model ignores the effect of emotions on stock returns. The passive investing model is rooted in the efficient market theory. And the efficient market theory ignores reality. It pretends that valuations do not matter, that it's not necessary to change your stock allocation when prices rise to insanely dangerous levels. And that has never worked in the past, and of course it has not worked this time. And it is the behavioral finance people who can tell us why that is so. And that's the approach to investing we examine at the PassionSaving.com website and in all these podcasts. I call it rational investing. Rational because I contrast it to passive investing, which is the emotional investing strategy. Rational because we take the effect of valuations into consideration. We change our stock allocations in response to huge changes in stock prices, whereas the passive investors fail to do that. The passive investors stick to the same stock allocation, regardless of where stock prices stand at any given time. I was very excited by that article, The Behavioral Revolution, in the New York Times. And I went this morning to look at it again and noticed something I hadn't noticed the first time, that there are community comments attached to the article. There were many community comments, hundreds of them, 525. And so I want to do this podcast mentioning some of the comments that were filed and commenting on them briefly. First, I wanted to commend the New York Times for the way they handled these comments. Something I notice that the New York Times does with the comments on their articles. The idea of having community comments on articles, I think, is wonderful. But many places you go on the web, the comments are just junk. And of course, what happens is the same thing we see happen at the retire early boards and the indexing boards when we're trying to get people to examine personal finance, share strategies on personal finance questions. Negative, abusive posters drive out good, constructive posters. And all that is needed to keep things constructive is for the people who own the site to take some action when they see abusive posting. And every board I've ever been to promises to do this. But a number that I have been to have failed to take action against highly abusive posters. And when you do that, the quality of discussions goes down, 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 because the good people are offended, they're repulsed by the tactics used by the abusive posters. And of course, other abusive posters think it's wonderful. They're attracted to it. And I see here that in these New York Times comments, they did not remove many comments. They removed a few. But that sent a signal to the other people participating so that the level of discussion is very high. And it's not really discussion, it's comments. There were 525 comments filed. They're not discussing back and forth. And something else the New York Times does is that they have an editor go through these comments, and then if you want to look at, they call it something like editor's choice, you can look at the comments that they view as being the best comments. And that's a great feature, because reading 525 comments takes a long time. But if an intelligent editor goes through and puts the best ones all together, and you can just press a button and see only the editor selections, it makes it much more feasible for someone trying to learn what people think about this article to find some intelligent comments. And that obviously costs money. That doesn't happen for free. You have to pay someone to do that. But I commend the New York Times for doing that. It makes their articles more valuable than they would be if they hadn't put that effort into the job. So I think that's great. Now, I'm just going to go through some comments and filed by others in response to the David Brooks article, The Behavioral Revolution, and then I will offer my own thoughts about the comments that I look at. Here's a comment. It may be that ups and downs are part and parcel of economic cycles. Greenspan says it's a, quote, once-in-a-century credit tsunami. However, all these only seem to point, I think it might be, all this, only seems to point to our inability in identifying some simple and quantifiable core principle. Probably we are all learning. Three comments, I guess. Greenspan says it's a once-in-a-century credit tsunami. Well, there's never been a credit tsunami like this one, but we live in a different sort of economy, so I don't know. I think that comment by Greenspan is not terribly helpful. It suggests that this could not have been foreseen. And this absolutely could have been foreseen and was foreseen. As you'll see in some of these other comments, these are just comments filed by everyday people. These are not experts. But many of the people filing these comments said, I foresaw something like this happening. So if your average Joe and Jane on the street can see it's coming, you know, why can't someone like Alan Greenspan see that it's coming? So the suggestion that there was something here that was amazing and could not be foretold, I don't buy that. I don't buy that at all. I find that not helpful. I find it somewhat offensive. You know, there's never been a credit tsunami like this one, certainly, but I feel that he's trying to pass the buck with that comment. I don't like that comment. And then the next comment this person makes, however, all these seem to point to our inability in identifying some simple and quantifiable core principle. Well, I don't know what exactly that poster is getting at when they're looking for a simple and quantifiable core principle, but it can't help but make me think about the PE10 concept. PE10 is what we use to identify overvaluation at passionsaving.com. I'm sure the reference here is not to PE10, and PE10, it will not in a direct way tell you when you're going to suffer a credit tsunami. Obviously, PE10, it's not intended to do that. In an indirect way, though, it does do that. If you go back and look at economic history and identify times in U.S. economic history when there's been a large amount of fraud built into the system, you will find that there's a correlation with high valuation levels in the stock market. There's no direct relationship. There obviously could be fraud at times of low valuations, or there could be, in theory, there could be times of high valuations where there's not fraud. But a high valuation environment is conducive to fraud. Why? Because when money is sort of flowing around, and the money, unearned money, that's a critical part of it. When unearned money is flowing around, it changes how people respond to indications of fraud. I had a discussion with Drip Guy over at the Goon Central Board, and he was very agitated that I was saying that this stock crash was caused by overvaluation, that overvaluation, and I don't say it's the only cause, I say that overvaluation is the primary cause of the stock crash. And he was saying, oh no, you know, it's this, it's these banking problems, it's the credit, you know, the credit tsunami, the Greenspan's talking about. Well, obviously in a direct sense, that's the trigger, that's what caused it. But, and there are all sorts of causes for the credit tsunami. A lot of people look at Fannie Mae and what happened there. Subprime loans and all this sort of thing. But those aren't the only factors, but they are certainly factors. But think about what happened when subprime loans were being given out. You know, why did our politicians elect to set up the programs they did, to set out the rules that they did, that, you know, houses would be given to people who could not afford them? And one of the things that goes on is, at the top of this price bubble, stocks were valued at 3 times fair value. That means that anyone who had $10,000 in his or her stock portfolio really only had $3,500 of real money. The rest was cotton candy. Anyone who had $100,000 in their portfolio really only had $35,000. And anyone who had $1 million in his or her portfolio really only had $350,000. Well, don't you think that affects how those people respond to indications of a fraud or even to legislative proposals? One of the things that happens when we're flooded with money is, and this is very human, the book I'm working on in investing is called Investing for Humans. And the remarkable premise that I use is that knowledge that humans have acquired in all other fields of endeavor should be applied to the stock investing area as well. What a shocker. You know, what a controversial concept that we should use our common sense when investing. Well, what does your common sense tell you? How do humans react when, say that, just go to a casino. This is a perfect way of looking at it. Go to a casino or go to a racetrack. Look at what happens when someone wins big at a casino. They win a slot machine and they win, I don't know, $10,000. What do? They give tips. They give tips to the people, you know, who are working the table, or sometimes they give tips to their friends. They invite their friends to dinner. Or if they came on a trip with someone, they might even share a portion of the money with them. Maybe they pay for their transportation cost. That happens all the time. When someone has $10,000 come into their life, you know, for no reason, basically a windfall, it makes them feel generous. That's human. It's perfectly healthy. There's nothing wrong with it. Well, what do you think happens when someone who has legitimately saved $10,000 is being told on the bottom of his portfolio statement that he really has saved $30,000 because stocks are valued at three times their fair value? That person becomes more generous than they otherwise would be. That translates into that person supporting the idea of additional government programs to help people who can't afford homes to have them. Humans are good. They're not all good, but we have our good side. And the fact that we want to help people afford homes is certainly not a bad thing. It can be done improperly, and perhaps it was done improperly. But the fundamental motivation is good. It's generosity. But the trouble here is that generosity can be good or it can be bad. Generosity is a good thing in general, but you shouldn't be handing out money that you can't afford to hand out. If all you have is enough to feed your family and you're making big contributions to some charity, that's wrong. You need to start with the basics. But how do we know what the basics are, and how do we know what is excess charity when nobody knows how much money they have in their retirement account? The person who thinks they have $300,000 in their retirement account really only has $100,000. The rest is just cotton candy that's going to be blown away when the crash comes. So my point here is that PE10 cannot be used in a direct way to identify once-in-a-century credit tsunamis. But when the PE10 value goes above 20, you can be confident that these sort of problems are going to arise throughout our economy. They always have before. Every time we have gone above 20, we have run into these sorts of problems. And it's not coincidence. Here's a quote from the article. This meltdown is not just a financial event, but also a cultural one. Well, the problem was also not just a financial problem, it was a cultural problem. When you put phony numbers on the bottom line of everyone's portfolio statement, when you don't let people know how much they've actually saved for retirement, you're going to have bad decisions made at the government level, at the investing level, at the banking level, at all kinds of levels. This is why I argue for accurate reporting of the retirement numbers, that we should be able to know how much, you know, what sort of withdrawal rate is likely going to work, what sort of withdrawal rate is safe. It's so painfully obvious that accurate numbers are better than inaccurate numbers. But in the investing realm, this common sense observation does not apply. Many people in the investing realm prefer inaccurate numbers. That's the problem with the passive investing model, that it encourages that sort of mindset. So I would suggest we do have, I don't know about a simple and quantifiable core principle, but we can quantify when we're in trouble. And the best way I know to quantify it is to look at the valuation level of the stock market. And that will tell you. It'll be a signal. It doesn't give you all the information you need. You then have to investigate and get deeper. But it's a signal. It's a signal that things have gone haywire. It's a signal that bad stuff is going on. And then the last statement here, probably we are all learning. Well, that's exactly the right spirit. If only that message could get out. What a simple message. Probably we are all learning. That's not what you hear from passive investors, is it? From passive investors, what we hear is, this is science. We will not be questioned. We know it all. No other investing model can ever work. All other investing models are financial porn. But passive investing is a science. Passive investing is backed by academic research. Passive investors do not need to be open to consideration of other viewpoints. I'm not making any of this up. This is all verified. This all can be verified by the Post Archives for the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. These are the arguments we hear from passive investing enthusiasts. Obviously, not all passive investors speak in such ways. The vast majority do not. But it's part of the passive investing model. That arrogance is part of the model. And I'd like to change that. I'd like to see that change. Passive investing would not be nearly as dangerous as it is if it were a less arrogant model. If the people who favor it could say, well, this is what we like to do, but we need to understand that others do things differently, that would be huge progress. And that would allow communities to self-regulate. It would allow communities to correct their mistakes as they are uncovered. And that's exactly how you avoid problems like this once-in-a-century credit tsunami. See, the problem here is that the thing got carried away. There obviously, you know, a lot of these comments will talk about greed. And of course, greed is an issue here. There clearly was greed. But greed is not the only issue. And if we just say it's all about greed, we're never going to get anywhere. Because greed is going to be with us. And we can't eliminate it. But there's more than just greed. Part of it is, how do you identify when the greed has gotten out of control? One of the questions here is, when do we need to regulate? This comes up over and over again. Well, you don't want to overregulate, because if you overregulate, you can cause problems with the economy. But you don't want to underregulate, because if you underregulate, you cause problems with the economy. Well, how do you know? One of the ways to know is to look at the level of overvaluation. When stocks are valued at 3 times fair value, we've got a problem, Houston. People should have taken action. And we can learn from this bad experience. We can learn and we can go forward with a determination to do better. This is a different statement. The fact that Greenspan states he didn't see this future event is denying his responsibilities. I actually do not accept this statement. I half agree and I half don't. Greenspan, it is his responsibility to have done something. So there was a failure on Greenspan's part. And that's true of all the experts who have endorsed passive investing in recent decades. All of the experts have responsibilities, but it's not only the experts who have responsibilities. In my view, I always see these things as a community events, and I really don't think you can make sense out of them any other way. Yes, Greenspan dropped the ball. But Greenspan, we don't know exactly why he dropped the ball. We can't get inside his head. But we know that he faced huge political pressures. And it wasn't under just one administration. It wasn't only under one political party. It was under both political parties. Greenspan served under both political parties. And he felt political pressure under both, I am confident. And it wasn't only political pressures he felt. He felt pressures to do what investors wanted. Greenspan is the one, you know, Robert Shiller is the godfather of the rational investing model. Robert Shiller is the one who came up with the phrase irrational exuberance, and he came up with that phrase for testimony that he delivered to Alan Greenspan. He delivered to the Federal Reserve when Alan Greenspan was chairman. This was 1996. So, Greenspan fits right in here. And Greenspan took it seriously. To his credit, Greenspan didn't just brush off what Shiller did. I don't know all the details. My understanding is that Greenspan took a look at what Shiller came up with. He took a look at the PE10 concept. He took a look at the valuation problem. And he was concerned about it. And then he made his statement, and you hear this quoted, and I can't quote it exactly, but he basically said, well, this tool has identified 10 of the last two recessions, something like that. You know, the point being that the PE10 tool will often point out that stocks are overvalued, that stocks are dangerous, and then stocks will do just fine for the next year. And that is absolutely true. Stocks, the irrational exuberance statement was made in 1996, and stocks did wonderful in 1997, 1988, and 1999. So we do not have a tool that will tell us the year when stocks will do poorly. That's all true. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't act when we know that valuations have gotten out of control, because you can push off the day of reckoning, but you can't push it off indefinitely. So Greenspan was under pressure in 96, and it's not necessarily even political pressure. There probably was political pressure, but, you know, sometimes people respond to political pressure by caving. Sometimes they respond by becoming that much more stubborn to resist it. But I think he felt pressure in his own mind. And one of the bits of pressure he felt was he probably wasn't sure that Shiller was right. Just as many of the people who have participated in our discussions in the retire early and indexing communities are not sure Shiller is right. So what do you do? Well, one of the things you can do is you try to understand how is it that humans make decisions. And one of the things we found is that we make decisions in groups. It's hard for someone like Greenspan or someone in a discussion board community to stand up for what they believe when the majority is speaking in opposition to them. And by definition, when valuations are out of control, the majority is going to be speaking out in opposition, because that's what overvaluation means. Means that people have become irrational in their support for stocks. So you're never going to be in the majority when you're speaking out against overvaluation. It's impossible. It's physically impossible. But we need to empower people who do speak out, so that someone like Greenspan will feel that he's not a loner. He doesn't have to rely only on Robert Shiller. You know, what if the peer review process and the academic community were changed so that it wasn't only Robert Shiller making that testimony, but it was a group of 20 academics showing up at the Federal Reserve making that statement? Shiller might have then had the power behind him that he could go to political leaders and say, no, we need to do something about this overvalued stock market. We can't allow this to continue. But Shiller was often a voice crying in the wilderness. Even today, that's to a large extent true today. Here's a comment I like, very short, sweet, right to the point. Wasn't the myth of economic man debunked decades ago? It was. There, the model we use today, passive investing, is rooted in the efficient market theory. The efficient market theory is the myth of economic man, the idea that stock investors are rational actors. They are not, and this has indeed been debunked decades ago. We know it's not true. We're in a weird twilight zone today where the efficient market theory was discredited in the 1980s, and it's now 20 years later, and we're still pretending that we believe in it, and we're all suffering financially as a result. I would like the day to come when we stop pretending. And the thing that's going to make that happen is people of courage and heart and intellect. Courage first, heart second, intellect third. Need to speak up in opposition to the taboo on telling the truth about stock investing. The truth is the efficient market theory does not describe reality. Stock investors are not rational actors. Stocks at times become wildly overpriced or wildly underpriced. It does not make sense to stay at the same stock allocation when stocks are wildly overpriced. We know it's true. The evidence is overwhelming. There is no evidence on the other side, and it cannot be said. These words cannot be spoken today without suffering, you know, huge consequences. That needs to change. The myth of economic man has indeed been debunked, as this person filing a comment on the New York Times article, The Behavioral Revolution, points out. Here's another comment. I think the idea that agents in a market are rational or act in their best interest was never really thought, or hasn't been in a long time, thought of as true in economics theory. People have been working with models with, quote, boundedly rational, in parentheses, read stupid, agents for quite a while, and the models are considerably more realistic. The rational agent was merely an assumption made in the beginning of some economic theories that made the problems much easier to solve analytically. That there is a problem with initial perception is reasonable and has been studied. However, the irrationality of people in markets, example, the stupidity, selfishness, short-sightedness, etc., has a much better effect. The same comment I made on the last comment applies. We've known for a long time that the market is not efficient. We need to stop pretending that we think it is. A lot of people are, it's crazy. We're in this twilight zone, and you go to experts and you ask them, why do you still endorse passive investing when we know the efficient market theory doesn't hold water? And they'll just say, oh, well, you know, we don't have anything better. I guess it's okay to just keep doing it. Everybody else does it. I guess I'll do it. You know, these are not good answers. People have their retirement money riding on this. If the efficient market theory doesn't work, then we should stop advising people to invest as if it did. At the very least, we should stop with the dogmatism. At the very least, if this theory does not stand up to scrutiny, then at the very least we need to tell people you need to at least be open to other theories, other models. You can't just keep giving the same old advice. But I think this person is exactly right where he says it was merely an assumption made in the beginning of some economic theories. I think that's how the efficient market theory got started. The initial intent, I think, was good. The idea was to use data to study investing. And they had to simplify. You know, there are so many factors that apply that if you try to study all the factors at one time, you can't study anything. So they had to simplify. So they just said, well, wouldn't it be simple if everyone were a rational actor? Why don't we just, let's make that our assumption and then examine. And that's fine. That's research. There's nothing wrong with that. But then when this academic material got turned over to Wall Street, I think they started to forget that there was this assumption behind it. That it wasn't an attempt to actually describe reality. It was just a working assumption that allowed people to do some calculations and maybe come up with some tentative ideas that would need to be confirmed with further research. They, you know, and then I think in Wall Street they developed all these marketing campaigns. They said, well, let's market this stuff. People will love it. Now we can tell them to buy stocks and it's safe because we've got academic research backing it up. It's a gold mine. So they went to the marketing departments, and the marketing department said, They surveyed, I don't know that this is true, I'm speculating. They surveyed people and they said, what do middle class people want to know before they put their money down in stocks? They want to know that their strategies are prudent, long-term strategies. Hey, this efficient market theory stuff, we could make that sound prudent. There are things we could do. There are slogans we could come up with. What if we said timing doesn't work? We can say that because some forms of timing surely don't work. So we could say timing doesn't work, and that sounds prudent. That sounds prudent. That will get us credibility in the eyes of middle-class investors. The problem is it's not true. Long-term timing is required to invest effectively for the long term. You must change your stock allocation when prices get out of control. So the marketing slogan ended up hurting us. But we could have known that. You can't blame people for coming up with marketing slogans, but the academics, when they saw how their research was being used, that the conclusions that were being drawn from it were not reasonable ones, they could have stepped in and said, wait a minute, this is out of hand now. You know, stock prices are at absurd levels. We didn't mean to suggest that people could stick with the same stock allocations when prices are three times fair value. But we haven't had enough of that to get the, you know, we haven't had enough of that to prevent this crash. And we still haven't had enough of it. Here's one of these people that mentioned. He says, it wasn't that hard to see this meltdown coming. I'm no financial expert, but I saw it coming. I just didn't know when the house of cards would fall. Well, I've seen a lot of that at the retire early boards and the indexing boards. How many times have I said I have that podcast? It's one of my favorite ones. I know more about stock investing than John Bogle, and you can too. I came up with that title because I ran into probably 100 people at the Vanguard Diehards Board who understood the fundamentals of stock investing better than John Bogle. Lots of people think that's impossible. Oh, John Bogle knows everything, but he doesn't. He's a human like all the rest of us. He gets caught up in this stuff, this emotional stuff like all the rest of us. Greenspan says he didn't see it coming, and I don't doubt that Bogle says he didn't see it coming. Or if he did see it coming, he sure didn't do much to warn us, did he? He saw it coming on some level. But he didn't want to see it. He saw it and he didn't at the same time. I think that's true of Greenspan, Bogle, and many, 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 many others. Here's another comment. Mr. Brooks realizes that the human heart and mind cannot be trusted to regulate itself, and perhaps regulation is required from government to prevent the extreme results of self-regulation. There probably will be government regulation. You know, if you look at other stock crashes, you will see that this always happens. But it's not only government regulation. The way the person here says it is, the human heart and mind cannot be trusted. That's the right way to say it. And government regulation cannot always regulate the human heart and mind. I don't say there's not a need for government regulation, but I think there's a need for other kinds of regulation. My favorite regulation, this is what I think would be huge, is to have, and you wouldn't have to legislate this, it could be done voluntarily, if the major newspapers would simply report valuation-adjusted numbers when they report the Dow, where the Dow is and where the S&P is. In other words, instead of saying the Dow is today 12,000, when the market is valued at double fair value, why not say the Dow is today nominally 12,000, adjusted for fair value, it's 6,000. Then people would know that this extra money that's showing up in their portfolio statement isn't real. It's a temporary, artificial phenomenon. It's going to be blown away in the wind. And they wouldn't change their decision-making based on it. I think that one change, one very simple change, would be huge. It would have huge implications. it would affect the markets. If people knew that stocks were double their fair value, lots of people who are trying to provide for their retirements would lower their stock allocations because they would understand that a stock crash is coming. And that's what we should want to have happen. We should all want to have prices as close to fair value as possible. Whenever prices go too far above fair value, they end up in the future going too far below fair value. So the goal should always be moderation. The goal of all responsible, long-term oriented investors and experts should be to do all we can to bring prices down to fair value. And the problem with the stock crash is that things got so out of control. We got to a point where, you know, I think when we got to 20 on the P10 value, you had people speaking out against it. You know, Shiller gave his irrational exuberance speech in 96. I don't know where. I think we were roughly at 26. I don't know exactly. But then when things went up to 44, you couldn't even talk about it. It became absolutely taboo because all of the people that had money riding on it, they were more afraid of a stock crash than they were when it was at 26. In other words, this is really a case where a stitch in time saves nine. When you go above 20, that's when you want to speak out. Because then all you need to pull it down to is, say, 16. You don't need this huge price crash to get back to fair value. But when you're at 44 and you need to go to 14, you're in a whole heap of trouble. And we never should have allowed it to get that far. Human beings, this is a different comment. Human beings' greatest characteristic that sets us apart from other species is our unique ability to make decisions with the higher mammalian functions of our minds, namely our ability to reason. Human beings' greatest weakness is our tendency to let our lower brain functions play a dominant part in our decision-making process, namely our ability to rationalize. Yes. This is why you can't trust investing experts. Investing experts are quote-unquote smarter than us. They've studied the books more than we have. They have more experience. But all that means is that they're more subject to the biases that are present in the books. During wild bull markets, the books are tilted heavily. They don't tell the straight story. Passive investing always becomes popular at times of extreme prices. Passive investing is just another name for emotional investing. It goes under different names each time it's tried. It always fails. But you're never going to have, at a time when prices are sky high, you're never going to have most investing experts telling you that. If they told you that prices were sky high, they wouldn't be sky high anymore. People would sell. So by definition, the experts can't protect us from overvaluation. We have to protect ourselves. This is why I favor looking at the historical data, because the historical data is a different kind of investing expert. The historical data is objective. It's not subject to these subjective biases. So as long as you look at the historical data in an analytically valid way, it will tell you the straight story. The historical data doesn't care if it hurts your tummy for the historical data to tell you the truth about stock investing. The historical data isn't worried about, you know, if it tells the straight story, you're going to cancel your advertising in that newspaper. The historical data doesn't know and doesn't care. That's the benefit. That's the benefit of using the historical data for guidance on questions like this. Humans make our biggest mistakes when we fail to understand that all our decision-making is subjective in a fundamental way. Like the Heisenberg principle states, since by just viewing the situation we affect the outcome, nothing is truly divorced from the biases of the observer. If you're going with a high stock allocation, you cannot be objective about stocks. You've got too much riding on it. Now, if you take that statement alone, you might say we're doomed. I don't think we're doomed, but I think we need to always be aware of that danger. It's the biggest risk of stock investing. It's that once you buy stocks, your information processing mechanisms become biased. You're emotionally invested. And you don't want to hear that your choices are bad ones. So you need to think, you need to always be aware of that risk. One way to counter that risk is to not go so high on your stock allocation. If that's what it takes, that's a good idea. You should only go with a high stock allocation if you're really sure that you're capable of being open-minded and you're capable of looking at the downside of stocks as well as the upside. If you're not 100% sure, you should be lowering your stock allocation, because emotions are more important than numbers. Emotions trump numbers. And what we need is a national debate where we start talking about what can we do to make ourselves aware of this greatest risk of stock investing? What can we do to protect ourselves? If we don't talk about it, we're not going to learn. If we ignore it, we're going to get killed. Here's a different comment. A second factor, I believe, is that our system of education does not graduate people capable of careful analysis. Rather, it delivers those who can cram and regurgitate. I just took note of that comment because I remember back at the Motley Fool Board, I used to hear all the time, people would say, oh, we should teach about investing in high school. It's a sin that people graduate high school and they don't understand all the wonderful things we understand. Now, on one level, I agree with that. I obviously favor the idea of people understanding money subjects more than they do. This is the field I work in, and I obviously want to increase understanding. But I never felt comfortable with that idea of teaching this in school, because my question was, what is it we're going to teach exactly? Are we going to teach passive investing? Is that going to help? We're going to tell people in high school, don't lower your stock allocation when prices go nuts? Is that going to help? That would have made the situation worse. If we're going to start teaching this, we first need to get it right. And what this person suggests is that what we really need to teach is teach people how to think, teach independent thinking. And if you teach independent thinking, people will see through the holes of whatever investing model happens to be popular at a given time. You know, we're now probably entering an era when the popular, conventional idea of stocks is going to be negative. You know, just as the hyper-emotionalism of passive investing, the other side of that coin is a hyper-anti-stock emotionalism. So what are we going to do? We're going to teach in schools that people should have zero stock allocations? What we should be teaching in schools are principles that would apply in both bull markets and bear markets. So that's what rational investing is intended to be, but we're barely we're not even at the discussion stage yet. You know, I've put forward some ideas, and others, of course. I don't mean that I'm the only one. Schiller and all these others have put forward ideas to develop a more sensible, more realistic model. But we haven't even had a national debate on this, so I think it's too soon to be introducing it into the school curriculum at the high school level. Here's another comment. I suggest that psychologists learn some basic control theory that every system engineer must learn as part of their basic education. The market system, especially the supply and demand law, is essentially a negative feedback loop. The stability of such systems is conditional, and in the language of mathematics, the system is stable as long as the poles of the Laplace transform stay on the left half of the complex plane. When any move to the right, the negative feedbacks become positive feedbacks and the system becomes unstable. Well, I have no idea what that what that guy is trying to tell us, but it sounds important to me. What caught my attention was he mentioned system engineers, and I believe, I'm not sure, I know that John Walter Russell is an engineer. He's the fellow who does the statistical research for the development of the rational investing model. I believe he may have been a system engineer, or if not, I'm confident he knows what this fellow's talking about. But read the stuff at John's site. He has an article. It's wonderful. It's an article about, you know, how is it that he was able to see these things that so many other smart people don't see? And I think he talked about being a system engineer. I'm not sure if that's what he called himself. I believe it is. And he talked about the process by which you study a problem so that you can identify flaws in the logic. And it's great stuff. That's what investing needs, some standards, some logical, systematic approaches to filtering out all the junk. The problem with investing isn't that we don't have good information. We have tons of good information. The problem is the good information is buried with all the junk. 90% of what is out there is junk. 10% is pure gold. I don't need to add to the gold. What I need to do is to somehow help you identify the junk so you can sweep away all the junk and then benefit from all the gold. That's the trick. That's what I try to do in these podcasts. I'm trying to give you a way to think about this so that you're able to filter out the junk, because that's the whole job. John's website is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. Check that out and learn more about system engineering. A great follow-up article would be a discussion on how best to regulate, theories on regulating, etc. I think that's right. Behavioral finance tells us that, I don't want to go through the article again. Please listen to the earlier podcast. It was called The Greenspan Mistake. But this article talks about how there are three steps to every decision. And the focus today with the passive investing model is you calculate what course is in your best interest. But behavioral finance says we have to go to the first step, which is where you perceive a situation, because it's our perceptions of reality that are the real problem. And what we need to learn is, how do we regulate ourselves? How do we regulate discussions of investing? How do we regulate experts in this field, people who purport to be experts? How do we regulate? You know, how does the Federal Reserve regulate? How does the Congress regulate? How are banks regulated? All these things. How do we govern ourselves so that we will avoid massive stock crashes, which cause massive human misery? Here's a comment. Greenspan's surprise at banks not protecting the long-term interest of shareholders can't be sincere. Well, that's what I call the cynical take, and I understand where it's coming from. There are a lot of these figures, you know, in the banking field. They've made million-dollar salaries. They've walked away with golden parachutes. And a lot of people with much smaller sums of life savings have been wiped out. And there's anger. And it's a righteous anger to a point. It's justified to a point. But there's a danger in giving into that anger. Just like there's a danger in giving into greed, and there's a danger giving into fear, there's a danger in giving into your righteous anger, because these things couldn't have happened without our participation. Now, that is a stone-cold fact. I put much more responsibility on the quote-unquote experts than I do on the middle-class investors. But I distance myself from claims that it's all the fault of the experts. Because of what I learned during the Great Safe Withdrawal Right debate. The experts, their behavior was unacceptable. But the behavior of a lot of the middle-class investors was also not good. And if we wanted the experts to tell us the truth, they would. If we pressed them, if we insisted. And I don't believe, although I do believe some of these banking people are overpaid, some of them, I'm sure, were hurt in very serious ways. So to suggest that none of them suffered any penalty, I don't think that's true. And I don't think that Greenspan wakes up in the morning saying, you know, how can I destroy as many lives as possible in as short amount of time as possible? Any more than I believe that the authors of the old school safe withdrawal rate studies woke up one morning and said, how can we come up with numbers that are totally off the wall and cause millions of busted retirements? These are overly cynical viewpoints. And there's a danger in that. The danger is that you adopt a comic book view of what's going on in the world and you don't fix the real problem. Part of the problem goes to the human heart. Are these bankers are greedy? Yes. So are we. We're not going to eliminate greed from the face of the planet. But I do believe it's practically possible to put some checks on it. You know, I mentioned, you know, I'll do a separate podcast someday on steps we need to take. But I mentioned one earlier in this podcast, just having the newspapers report the fair value of the S&P and the Dow, that would make all the difference in the world. It would change the conversation about investing. Every time people started dancing in the streets because stocks had gone up again, they'd be able to see that the increase in valuations had caused the safe withdrawal rate to go down. The increase in valuations had caused the long-term return on stocks to go down. That's why I love the stock return predictor, the calculator at my website. It's emotionally balanced. Whenever valuations go down, the long-term return, the expected long-term return goes up. Whenever valuations go up, the expected long-term return goes down. So every price change has both a positive component and a negative component. Using that calculator encourages emotional balance. And it may be that some action needs to be taken, you know, in regards to greed, where there are cases where it's proven and all this sort of thing. But I think giving in to that emotional desire to, you know, punish, I think that can be a trap. I don't say we should ignore it altogether. There's a place for it. But I think it's sometimes harder to look inside and more constructive in a long-term sense, to look inside, to look at how we can change ourselves so that we don't fall for the trickery, which is sometimes deliberate and sometimes not. I think in many cases the trickery was not deliberate, or it was partly deliberate. I think a lot of times the experts, they have a foggy idea. They're not stupid, you know. They have an idea that there's something wrong here. How could you not? But they don't grasp it because they don't want to grasp it. And we need to press them. We need to press them so that they have no choice but to grasp it. But that's our job. It's a community effort. We all have a role to play. It's important not to confuse rational thinking with an irrational economic system. The former has underpinned 2,000 years of progress. The latter is on its last legs. Well, I don't know. The suggestion there is that our economic system is on its last legs. I hope that that's an overly dramatic statement. I don't know if the person meant for it to sound quite so dramatic. But, you know, if the reference was to passive investing, well, I'm all for that failing. But I think the reference sounds broader than that. An irrational economic system. It sounds like he's talking about, I don't know, free enterprise capitalism. That's what it sounds like to me. So I hope that that's not on its last legs. But if the thought is that there's a need for some reform, then perhaps so. There's the earlier points in that same comment have to do with risk modeling, and the risk modeling. I'm not an expert in that aspect of the question, but I think a lot of this risk modeling, this quantitative risk modeling, is a lot of it is gibberish. Clearly, I'm sure all of it has some basis in truth. The trouble, just as we see with the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, is give people some numbers and boy, watch out. They use them like clubs. They don't understand that numbers have value. I'm opposed to anti-intellectualism. Numbers have value. Quantifying things yields insights. But you have to use these techniques with caution. That's what's been lost, is the caution. There's a comment like that somewhere in here. There were so many comments filed, I may not get to it. I hope I do. This, this comment I love. It's just very simple. If the market doesn't work, the implications are huge. Yes, that's what I'm always trying to tell people. This is a big story. It's the biggest story of my lifetime. People ask me all the time, Rob, you know, we hit you over the head. We do all this stuff. Why do you keep at it? Why don't you give up? And the answer is I'm a reporter. And this is the biggest story of my lifetime. I'm 52 years old, and there's never been a story as big as this. It's huge. If the market doesn't work, the implications are huge. And that's what this article is claiming, the behavioral revolution, the article, it's saying the markets don't work. And they don't. It's a fact. I mean, they work in the sense that they function. But middle-class people are putting their retirement money into stocks today. People don't seem to grasp this. We found out in the Retire Early community that the numbers we use to plan our retirements are wildly wrong. We found this out in May of 2002, and the studies to this day are not corrected. And to this day, we have quote-unquote experts defending them, saying there's no need to correct them. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Here's a good comment. This reminds me of a quote to the effect that humans are basically rationalizing creatures as opposed to rational. Does that sound like anybody you know? The efficient market theory presumes we are rational. The reality is that we are rationalizing. We start with the emotion, we decide what we want to do, and then we concoct theories to back us up. That's what passive investing is. There has never been any evidence, scientific evidence, that it's a good idea to leave your stock allocation at the same level when prices get out of control. There has never been any evidence to support that. There never will be. But there are lots of quote-unquote studies saying it's a good idea. That's rationalizing. We decided that those are the kind of studies we wanted to see. And then the people who supply us with studies satisfied our demand for studies showing that. That doesn't make it true. Edwin Hubble once said that there is no observation without some theory of how the world works. The meaning is very clear. How can we put one foot in front of the next with any confidence if we don't apply a hefty filter to the data streaming at us from all sides? Our minds must simplify the world to a model that we can comprehend, and all evidence is filtered in regard to that model. Bias is how we get by. It is an unavoidable product of the human condition. Knowing that we rationalize for the most part to suit our filter and justify ourselves should enable policymakers to go beyond ideology and confront the poverty of the human condition more directly and effectively, but then we would not be human. Well, that's a, you know, there's some paradox in that comment, and I love paradox. I think that's a very intelligent and on-point comment. We are biased, and ultimately, that's always going to be true. I don't claim that rational investing is going to change that fundamental human reality. What I believe is that we behave more rationally in areas other than investing than we do in the investing realm. You know, we have something called speed limits when people drive. Because we know that if we don't have speed limits, some people are going to do crazy things and get themselves and others killed. That's what we need in the stock market, speed limits. We have laws against drunk driving because we know if we don't have such laws, some people are going to do irrational things and get themselves and others killed. We need laws against drunk driving in the stock realm. People get hurt when they hear these convoluted theories that don't hold water. I don't say we should ban the theories, you know, but we need to allow people who have problems with the theories to speak up. We need to encourage them to speak up so that people at least know that there are dangers. You know, it's the difference between cigarette smoking is legal, but it's not encouraged. But passive investing is encouraged. It's not just that it's legal that's the problem. It's that it's encouraged. We have experts. We all have a get-rich-quick impulse. We all have human weaknesses. We all want to overinvest in stocks at times of high prices. But many of us know through common sense that that's a bad idea. But our common sense gets beaten down when we hear, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work. It wears us down. We need to have some sort of restraints on that sort of advice. What the nature of those restraints is to be, I think is a different question. You know, one of them would be if the newspapers would report valuation adjusted numbers. But, you know, if discussion boards would open up, investing discussion boards would open up to honest posting on the flaws of the safe withdrawal rate studies, I think that would be a big step. We've seen thousands of people interested in learning the realities of stock investing at our boards. So why not satisfy the interest that those people have in learning? And the more people learn, you see, it multiplies. Once one person learns, he teaches three others, and then that person, each of those three teach three others, and rational investing ideas just spread and spread and spread. This is why the passive investing enthusiasts are so dogmatic about, you know, stomping it out. You let people learn what the historical data says, and who knows where it's going to stop. Here's the comment I was thinking of. It is about time. Nearly 50 years ago, Professor Edwin Witt, president of the American Economic Association, warned of the dangers of using mathematics in economics. Well, I'm not against the use of mathematics, but I sure do see the dangers. You know, I tend to be, my critics tend to fall into two categories. There's the group that says the old school studies are right, they're not analytically invalid. And then there's the group that recognizes that the studies are analytically invalid, but they say, oh, well, it doesn't matter. You know, nobody trusts these numbers anyway. And my view is that the numbers, the idea of using numbers is a good thing. Analytically valid studies help people to understand the realities of stock investing. It's not the numbers that are the problem. But yes, this fellow who warned of the dangers, he's right on. Numbers have power that words do not have. So if you're going to report numbers, you've got to be responsible. And today, The numbers that we get in the investing area today are not responsible, as a rule. It's not just that there are rare cases where irresponsible numbers are given. It's the rule is irresponsible numbers. The responsible numbers are the exception. So that is a problem. The complexity and fallibility of human decision-making has been underestimated by classical economists. They should have read Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. Classical economics assumes an infinite number of perfectly rational producers and consumers. Real economies usually don't have even one. That's true. We're all humans. There are no rational actors in the stock market. It's okay to assume there are for the purposes of doing a study, but it's not okay to then take the results of that study seriously. The study might point you to some future research, but you can't give out those answers without tons and tons and tons of reservations and caveats. And all the reservations and caveats have been forgotten in the selling of passive investing. Then this fellow makes a sort of depressing point. He says, I'm not sure what the world's response to the current crisis will be, only that the cure will be even worse than the disease. Well, yeah, he might be right, but let's pray that he's not right. The cycle of growth, speculation, mania, and crash has been with us since the Dutch tulip craze. Nothing new to look at here, folks. Just move along. There's a lot of truth in that. But there are some differences, and the big difference that I think of is that the middle class today has its retirement money in stocks, and that means that I think we need to be a little more serious about the advice we give in the stock investing realm than we have been in the past. That's Rob Bennett's opinion. In an effort to quantify the unquantifiable, financial institutions have deceived themselves and us about how risky many investments are. That's true. But again, let's not rule out quantifiable information, because quantifiable information can help. All of John Walter Russell's research is quantifiable. He uses numbers to show us how humans affect stock investing. So let's not throw out the good numbers along when we're throwing out the bad numbers. I'm going to shut this down. My amazement came in the face of Mr. Greenspan's amazement. While I'm no social scientist, my life experience has taught me that we are emotional creatures, not rational ones. The simple fact is, people do what other people do. Heavens, isn't that the basis of modern advertising? Yes. Modern advertising teaches us that we all want to do what others do, and we all want to do what we're told thousands of times to do. That's why you haven't been told one time that timing doesn't work. You've been told 10,000 times. The goal of these marketing pitches is to shut down your mind. And you've been told 10,000 times to buy and hold, and you've been told 10,000 times stay the course, and you've been told 10,000 times stocks for the long run, and you should be suspicious of anything you're told 10,000 times. Here's another comment along the same lines. The words, the ideas, the bumper sticker slogans, the pundits, the church speeches, the discussion, the culture counts. We soak in information from the culture. And when so many people are telling us this gibberish, our BS detectors get turned off, and we need to turn them back on. We need to understand that a lot of this stuff is marketing, not science. It's the opposite of science. David Brooks, welcome to radical economics from the 1950s. You do realize that behavioral economics is just sociology pimped out for pro-corporate purposes, don't you? Well, I don't know if that's t- totally true. That statement sounds a little harsh, but I do suspect that behavioral, you know, economics is not is nothing. Behavioral finance is nothing new under the sun. The idea of rational investing has been with us since the first stock market opened for business. So has the idea of passive slash emotional investing. The battle will be waged forevermore. The goal is not to bring the battle to a close. The goal is to lead us to a better place than where we are today, to a place where at least those who are trying to tap into realistic investing strategies can find them. They can sort through all the junk and find the real stuff. That's our goal in the behavioral revolution. Good luck with your investing strategies.